We also didn't used to use the word spiritual very much because it's the same problems as meditation. And also we wanted to, you know, emphasize that these can be secular practices. You don't have to start out with the idea, with spiritual ideas.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, this is Nishant, and welcome to another episode of the Nishant Girl Show. The mission of the show is to spread mindfulness awareness, and my job on the show is to invite world-class experts to extract the practices, routines, and habits to live a fulfilled life. Today's guest is Mirabai Bush. Mirabai Bush teaches contemplative practices and develops programs through the application of contemplative principles and values to organization life. Her spiritual studies include 2 years in India with Hindu teacher Neem Karoli Baba, meditation in monasteries with Buddhist teachers. Mirabai Bush was a co-founder of the Center for Contemplative Mind in Society and served as executive director there until 2008. Mirabai has traveled, tracked, and lived in many countries, including Mexico, Costa Rica, India, Nepal, Morocco, and many other countries. She is an organic gardener in Western Massachusetts and the mother of one adult son. Her new book with Ram Dass is Walking Each Other Home, Conversations on Loving and Dying. In this episode, Mirabai talks about her journey in India in 1970s, her meditation practice on loving everyone, forgiveness, Buddhist meditation, why we need guru, and much, much more. So to learn more, keep listening. Mirabai Bush, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Love being with you.
This is my honor. This is my pleasure to have you, speaking to you. I'm so excited. I can't express what I'm feeling right now. And today when I opened my mailbox, I received your book, Walking Each Other Home. And it had an autograph from you, and I was so touched. So thank you so much for doing that to me.
Great.
Can we start with something, your journey back in India in 1970s?
Sure. Yeah. And I'd actually like to, because I know we want to talk about mindfulness. And first, I'll tell you an interesting story that around 2007 and 8, I worked with Google to create a basically mindfulness-based and compassion-based program for their students, for their engineers. And we called it Search Inside Yourself because they're the big search engine. And it became very, very popular. But then people would come from Google all over the world and come to San Francisco and learn how to teach this in their centers. And at one time, they asked me to come back and give a talk, and I said, what do you want me to talk about? And they said, tell us how we got here. I said, okay. So I started thinking about my life, just what you're asking me now, about going to India. And I put some slides together, and I told them my story, which I'll expand in a minute, of going to India and meeting teachers and learning mindfulness and other practices. And then in 1970, where you couldn't learn to meditate in this country, just about nobody was teaching it. So then I came back, and there were, you know, some early teachers who were Japanese, and my first teacher was Burmese and then Indian. And so I showed pictures of these different teachers, and then we went on to talk about all the ways in which mindfulness is helpful. And when it was over, because it's Google and global, there were people from many parts of Asia. And so they were from Singapore and Japan and, of course, India and China. And so the first person came up to me and said, Mirabai, thank you so much. She said, we didn't know that mindfulness came from Asia. we thought it was an American thing, and that's why we came all this way to learn it. And then one after another, almost all the East Asian people who were there came up and said the same thing. And then later, I was invited to Kyoto to give a talk about this very thing, Kyoto. So I'm glad you asked that, because I realize that many people think that, but it has deep and ancient roots, you know, 2,500 years. And I discovered it in 1970, which was a very time of a lot of violence and unrest in this country. It was the time of the Vietnam War, and I was very involved in racial civil rights. And I was teaching on a campus, State University of New York, and the police came and took over the campus because the students were demonstrating so much. It was not so different from right now. And so we couldn't teach. I decided I would go travel and see if there was any place in the world that seemed to be leading a saner life, that where I could feel that it was more compassionate, peaceful, yeah, sane. And so I traveled through Europe and the Middle East, and I ended up in India. And I didn't really know what I was looking for. I didn't know about meditation, so I wasn't really looking for a meditation teacher. But the first day I was in Delhi, another Westerner, Sharon Salzberg.
I was born in Delhi.
This is 1970. What year were you born?
I was born in 1987.
Okay. Well, we were setting the stage for you. So this was in Connaught Place Circus. And I met Sharon Salzberg, who's also a mindfulness meditation teacher. And she and I were, you know, just young in India for the first time. And she told me, I hadn't known her before, but she told me that there was a meditation course being taught in Bodh Gaya, where the Buddha had been enlightened, by a Burmese Buddhist teacher for the first time for Westerners. And so, you know, it sounded cool. I didn't really have any idea what I was getting into, but I went there. And the teacher was S.N. Goenka, who after that taught many thousands of people. And I learned mindfulness, loving kindness, and insight practices from him. And then he taught us one course. It was a 10-day course. He taught us one course, and there were about 75 of us. And most people, although we didn't have any idea what we're getting into, that we were going to be meditating in silence from 5 in the morning till 10 at night, but we loved it. It really, for me, it really reoriented me. I really saw that there was a way of exploring both the nature of reality and ways into leading a right life by going inside. And so we stayed for 4 courses in a row and 40 days of this. And then after that, many things happened. But the most important was I then also had an Indian teacher, Guru Neem Karoli Baba, who taught me what it means to be fully what you glimpse through these practices, you know, fully open, fully loving, fully present.
I will come back to this in a while. And before, I want to ask you that back in 1970s, you mentioned that mindfulness or meditation, nobody was teaching these practices in the Western world, especially in the US. How did you realize that you want to learn mindfulness or meditation? So how did you become aware about all these practices if nobody was teaching or talking about such things in the US?
Just by doing it. We had traveled through all these different countries and in the Middle East, and I had, you know, people had taken us into their mosques and into their churches, and we just were exploring everywhere. And so when I got to India and Sharon told me there's a meditation course, I thought, well, you know, when I was in Paris, I drank wine and ate cheese and you know, I guess I should learn to meditate. So I did. And it really, it utterly changed my life. And yeah, and then out of that unfolded many other practices, but that was the beginning.
So you were with Sharon Salzberg, and not to forget Ram Dass. You met Ram Dass in that trip.
Yes. He was also at that. He had been in India before, and he'd written his landmark book, Be Here Now. And then he came back to India, and he had just come back and had also heard about this course. And so was there. And as well as it was a real seed pod, there were other people who became meditation teachers in this country, Joseph Goldstein, Danny Goleman, and others. And yeah, I met him there. And then I traveled with him later, and Neem Karoli Baba was his guru, who he had written about and Be Here Now. And then he became mine also. And then we did many things after that, including just writing this book that I just sent you.
Yeah. I'm curious to learn more about Neem Karoli Baba. You have mentioned that he was called as Guruji. Is that correct?
He was Ram Dass's guru, yeah.
Did you ever meet Neem Karoli Baba?
Yeah. I met him right after those meditation courses. And I stayed there I thought I was going to stay in India for 2 weeks. I stayed for 2 years. And a lot of that time was with him, because I had never, ever experienced anybody like that. And I felt like I was learning so much about myself, about life. And I couldn't leave. I eventually left. I got married and was pregnant, and came home to have the baby, and he died in 73. And so I didn't see him again after that. But he was really amazing. And he didn't teach us practices. He didn't, if somebody wanted to, came and found him and said, because when Westerners would come to India, then they would expect that you would learn all these practices. And people came really wanting that. He would send them off to Goenka for meditation, or up to, you know, to the Shivananda ashram in Rishikesh to learn yoga. But he didn't teach practice. He just was a presence. I mean, you will understand that it was the practice of darshan. And just being with him. And he did tell us a few things. And the main thing he told me was, love everyone and serve everyone. So then that became a practice to try to figure out what could that mean. And I've spent the last 50 years trying to figure that out.
Loving everyone.
Yeah.
Sounds simple. Sounds easy. I'm curious to know, how do you practice loving everyone in this modern world, if we talk about 21st century?
Yeah. Well, you don't, I mean, I did not choose the path of like sitting in Times Square and, you know, just smiling at everyone. But I essentially bringing a loving heart, a loving stance, you know, love into everything that I've done. And then, so that, of course, there are many times when we don't feel loving toward people, toward situations. It really requires coming back over and over again and asking, what does that mean in this situation? What does that mean with this person? Exploring your own attachments to wanting things to be different from what they are. Really bringing mindfulness to the moment, seeing what's happening there, opening your heart. And, you know, it's not easy, but it's a great practice, because people like it when you love them. If you're genuine. And so that has to do with, discovering the truth. That's what mindfulness would, you know, we could say that it has to do with discovering the truth in every moment. So, you know, loving has to do also with, you know, really being, having integrity, being genuinely there for another person.
Can we practice loving ourselves and practice loving others through meditation?
Well, yeah, metta practice is often taught with mindfulness. That's how Goenka taught us at the end of, I think on the eighth day or something, we started practicing the opening the heart, breathing in and out of the heart, and then you bring to mind, first you work on loving yourself, which was interesting in that most of us didn't think that would come first. You know, when we think of love, you think of loving somebody else. But it turns out that in as much as you can love yourself, accept yourself, feel kindness and forgiveness and compassion for yourself, in as much as you can do that, you can love others. So that practice begins by, you know, a practice of bringing loving kindness to yourself, and then you send it out to others in increasing circles, and eventually you're sending it to all beings everywhere.
That is interesting. Metta meditation is powerful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I would like to ask you that you spent 2 years in India. You learned meditation and different practices over there. And after 2 years, when you came back to US, what changes did you see in yourself, or what changes did others see in yourself? Yeah. Because you were there for 2 years.
Yeah, it was radical. Especially then in 1970, India had not a lot of contact with the West then. You know, there were no imports, and, you know, they had gotten rid of the Raj finally. But it was, you know, there was no Google there. There were not a lot of young, handsome engineers running around making money. It was really old school. And you know, we lived that way for 2 years. We lived with very little, you know, we ate basically rice and dal and chapatis and puris and potatoes, and we lived with not much electricity, and we just lived really simply. And when I remember that I didn't read a newspaper for 2 years, and I'd been an avid newspaper reader before that. It was real. I didn't make a phone call for 2 years, because in those years you had to make a reservation at the post office, and then for a few days from then, and then you'd arrive and you had to stand in three lines before you got to the phone. So I remember I didn't call home for 2 years. So when we got back here, yeah, it was, I first lived on a farm, I delivered my son at home and lived on a farm in Quebec to try to reorient, and then slowly came back in, and then I lived in Cambridge, where Ram Dass had been at Harvard with Tim Leary, and they'd been exploring states of consciousness there, and they'd been using psychedelics. And they got fired from Harvard for giving psychedelics to their students.
Was it illegal at the time?
It wasn't illegal, no, but it did alter consciousness, and the school wasn't happy about that. So that's when he left and then went to India the first time, partly because he wanted to discover. He had read a lot of Indian philosophy, and he wanted to discover practices that, so that you didn't have to keep using psychedelics in order to explore vaster consciousness. And so, but when he'd been at Harvard, his rising professor, well, he was teaching, but the head of the department was a man named David McClellan. It was the Department of Social Psychology. And so through various changes, David and Mary McClellan, they were Quakers. All their kids had grown up and gone away. And they invited some of us, because he was still friends with Ram Dass, invited some of us to come and live in his big house in Cambridge. So Dan Goleman was there, and Richie Davidson, who does he has the primary lab on research on mindfulness at University of Wisconsin. was there, and Cliff Sarin, who does the mindfulness research at UC Davis. It was quite a pod, again, of particularly of the researchers, but then lots of other teachers would come through also. Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche had just started teaching in this country, and he was pretty extraordinary because he had studied in Lhasa and at Oxford. So he was someone who could bring East and West together in a way that at that point not many people could. So, yeah, so a group of us lived together and we helped each other re-enter. And then, you know, one thing led to another until this very day.
As we are speaking of mindfulness, I want to ask you, what does a mindfulness practice can do to a human being? What can a human being benefit from this mindfulness and meditation?
Well, there are many. People come to mindfulness for lots of different reasons. And, you know, I think at the first, and you know this, but at the first level, it can be calming, quieting, stabilizing. And you know, the research says that just 15 minutes of focusing on your breath starts dropping your cortisol levels, your stress hormone. It's kind of amazing. So it's very effective that way in reducing stress, in calming you down. And all of us know who've, you know, just done some deep breathing or even just regular breathing quietly for, you know, 10 or 15 minutes, you feel different. And that, you know, that's good for you in so many different ways. I mean, physically, it's very good and helps your immune system, which is important right now. But also, it begins to clear the mind and so that you can see things more clearly as they are. And then with more time and attention, then you begin to see the way that mind works. You see that everything is impermanent. Thoughts and emotions just arise. There they are. And then you don't act on them, then they just fall away. You see that. So you then from that, you begin to understand that, you know, it's all impermanent. And you become somewhat less attached to, like, the way in which we get stuck thinking this is never going to change. It's changing all the time. And mindfulness lets you see that.
What does your meditation practice look like these days?
Well, I always start with focusing on the breath and breathing, watching my breath, seeing what arises in my mind. With Ram Dass, I in recent years have been doing a simple practice called loving awareness, where once you're somewhat calmer and quieter, then you begin to imagine breathing in and out of your heart and just not trying to do anything, not trying to let go of your thoughts or anything, just sitting and silently repeating, I am loving awareness. I am loving awareness. And after a while, you begin to recognize the way in which you are loving awareness. You are not your thoughts. You are not, you know, only your body. You are awareness, which is watching your thoughts, aware of yourself being a human being. And it is, you can call it awareness, you can call it love. It is, you know, boundless and present.
So, can we say that through loving awareness meditation or any kind of meditation, we are going inward to our soul?
Yeah. Well, Ram Dass refers to the soul, and some people do, other people don't. Buddhists don't talk about the soul, and Hindus and Christians do, Jews less. But yeah, I mean, If that's how you understand it, then yeah, it's about identifying with the soul instead of simply the body and all of our attachments and our ideas about what the world is and about who we are in the world. It's about identifying with the part that doesn't change and doesn't die. And once you rest there or in awareness, then you can, well, you can certainly be more easily more loving, and you're just less attached to what's around. And when things happen that, you know, that you don't like so much, you recognize that it's all relative and that it is going to change, and it's, you know, it's not wholly who you are. And it brings a kind of lightness to what you do in the world. You're still acting fully in the world, but you're doing it from a different kind of place.
When I was reading your book, yours and Ram Dass' book, Walking Each Other Home, there is one line I read that you are agnostic these days. Is that correct?
Well, I grew up Catholic, and I was in Catholic school all the way from preschool through Georgetown graduate school. So I went to India and started doing Buddhist meditation, and had a Hindu guru, and I just know that I don't, it came up a lot around talking and writing about dying, because I feel like I don't know what's going to happen after this life. I don't know. I allow that any number of things could happen, but I know that I don't know, and I'm fine with that. And when I think of the divine, I really think of, you know, that way in which we are all interconnected and interconnected with nature, and just the miracle of every moment and every day. And I don't feel like I need to imagine, you know, a personal God in any way or goddess, although I honor it. You know, I grew up with it, and I loved, you know, I loved being in India and all the gods and goddesses. And, you know, Maharaji was really his Ishta Devi, his, you know, he was devoted to Hanuman, the embodiment of selfless service. And I love that. But I guess I say I'm agnostic because I don't identify with God through any religion.
I would like to state that since you mentioned that you are agnostic now and you still practice meditation and other mindfulness practices. So I think sometimes people feel that they have to be in a certain way to have meditation and mindfulness practices. Even if we are not sure or we don't believe in God, we can still practice meditation and mindfulness to get relaxed and to live a better life.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And in 95, I started an organization called the Center for Contemplative Mind and Society. And our mission was to bring these practices into secular settings in American life. And at that point, it's hard to imagine now where mindfulness is everywhere. But then the only place it was showing up was in health and healing, because Jon Kabat-Zinn had brought it in. But not other places. And so we did programs and explorations in many different areas of American life, business and law and education and activism and so on. And as part of that, we interviewed 80 teachers of contemplative practices from all religious and spiritual traditions, everything we knew about. And it was a fabulous project. And we asked them many questions about, you know, these practices, and we were interested in the relationship between the practices and social change. But also we asked them, you know, if we take these practices out of their original frames, containers, religions, or spiritual traditions, if we take them away from that, like mindfulness, well, mindfulness, a form of mindfulness we discovered exists in every spiritual and religious tradition. It's called mindfulness originally in Buddhism, but there are mindful practices everywhere. But mindfulness, mostly as it came into this country, is a practice that was most practiced through Buddhism. But so we asked, if we take them out of their original homes, what will happen? Is that bad to do? And just about every teacher from across the spectrum said, no, these practices have integrity on their own. They don't need to be attached to a religion. So anybody can practice them, and you don't have to practice in a religious context. But because we came to think of them as human practices, they're about waking up to ourselves and to the world and each other, and just leading, you know, a more compassionate life. But one thing they did say was that the thing that you lose by taking them out of their context is community. And there are different names for it in all the different traditions, you know, Sangha and Satsang and fellowship and minyan and so on. But that's an acknowledgement that, you know, it's very hard to do this alone, that we really need each other. It's most helpful to have someone who's a little further ahead of us on the path so that they can, you know, help us with what we're just beginning to see or struggling with. So that, you know, that could be a teacher or in India, guru, but, or just a spiritual friend. But also we all help each other. I mean, here we are doing a podcast, you know, and, you know,
yes.
Just in you and I meeting each other and like recognizing something and that, you know, that feels in alignment with what we're talking about. And just that helps us, you know, remember, oh yeah, I'm slowly making my way toward something that looks like it will help me live more fully in truth and love and kindness and justice.
And it reminds me of one of the statements from your book that I'm going to paraphrase that statement. We all have everything inside of us, but why we need guru? We need guru because a guru can show us what's there inside.
Yes. That was Chogyam Trungpa said that. I thought that was brilliant. It's that simple, really. You know?
And Buddhism, like Dalai Lama, Thich Nhat Hanh, they say that everything is inside of us, but how can we find what is inside of us? So we need a guru or a mentor to help us find that.
Yeah. Sometimes just life circumstances do it, but really for a sustained, because these practices are powerful and transformative. I mean, I started out saying, yes, you can feel centered and quieter and less stressful from doing a little bit. But if you really practice over time, they're transformative. They really change you and in deep ways. And yeah, and we need each other to do that. I mean, Suzuki Roshi, who taught in San Francisco, said, you're perfect just the way you are. And you could use a little improvement.
That is profound.
It's inside you, but you need someone to point that out.
And
yeah.
I would like to add this. I actually love what you said. We are perfect the way we are, but we can add improvement. And we try to fix ourselves. We feel that we are broken and keep learning new things. And if we improve ourselves from a place of that we are perfect, but we can add some improvement, that will give a new meaning into our life.
Yeah.
I would like to ask you about some contemplative practices that you have taught in higher education, in social justice organizations and the law firms. What are those contemplative practices? I'm not sure personally, if you could shed some light on that, please.
Well, you know, when we started the organization, we wanted to go into, as I said, mainstream. So we went into some corporations. We worked with the Yale Law School. We worked with the national organizations of philanthropists, you know, so we couldn't use the word meditation because it was still identified with, you know, hippies, and it was very marginal.
Buddhism.
And so we, after a little research, we came up with the word contemplative, which now has worked its way back into the culture. But
now this is popular. Now meditation is very popular everywhere.
So by contemplative, we really meant practices that both are work to increase awareness and are rooted in, and also are rooted in and increase our appreciation of community and connection.
Would you say that contemplative practice is as similar to spiritual practice, or they are same, just the different words?
We also didn't used to use the word spiritual very much because it's the same problems as meditation. And also we wanted to, you know, emphasize that these can be secular practices. You don't have to start out with the idea, with spiritual ideas, but you can enter these by simply, as I said, I like to call them human practices, by simply wanting to become more of who you are and to try to figure out, you know, how to do that and how to become that. So yes. It's a Venn diagram, you know, it's all overlapping.
Yeah. Is there any other meditation, or I should say any mindfulness practice that you have in your day-to-day life?
Yeah. Well, I think the ultimate integration of mindfulness is to be able to be mindful in whatever you're doing. And actually, when I first came back from India, and most others I was with wanted to be teachers right away, and most of them did. But I, as I said, had a baby right away. And in those years, you know, having a baby didn't go together with meditation or retreat centers. And also had to support this baby. So with my then husband, we started a business. It was called Illuminations. And anyhow, but we wanted to bring these teachings into America as much as everybody did. And so we basically built it on principles of karma yoga, of like seeing your everyday life, everything you do, as practice. And we would also do, you know, sitting on the cushion kinds of practices and yoga and so on. But we really worked to be everything that we did, including parenting, mothering, and being in business. And so that's been really important to me always. I just think in the beginning, people thought you could only practice if you went into a retreat center, you know, otherwise you're out in the in the world, you know. but it was clear to me from the beginning that you know, your life is your practice. So I would say I try to bring it into whatever I do, and you know, with various levels of success.
You are one of the very few people who brought mindfulness and meditation into the United States. Do you feel proud of that?
I don't know if proud is right. But, I mean, because mindfulness really teaches you to be humble. So I feel happy to have been used by the great unfolding, to have fallen into it when I did in India, and then to have appreciated it so much that I've been working on introducing it ever since. And yeah, what a great blessing, huh? I've loved it.
It is a blessing. in this conversation we have, and I remember, if I remember correctly, you somewhere you mentioned about the sadhana practice. Could you touch on that? What is sadhana practice?
Well, I use it as just doing your spiritual practice, whatever it is. And that if you, and that, as I said, karma yoga, thinking of your life as sadhana, thinking of your life as practice and waking up. And, you know, people, there are so many practices. We, on the Contemplative Mind website, it's contemplativemind.org, we have a tree of practices because we did another research project in which we asked people all over the place what their contemplative practices were. And there were many. And then we organized them into activist and relational practices that you do with another person, and movement like yoga and tai chi, and rituals and stillness practices and so on, creative practices.
Yes. I would like to ask you that you were also involved in directing a study for the U.S. Army on resiliency and performance among Army medical and other chaplain caregivers. So what did you teach and how did you help them through mindfulness? Because doing mindfulness practices and helping them, it's not an easy thing. So I'm curious to understand, how were you able to integrate mindfulness and resiliency
that's
practices?
A really big question. And sometime, maybe on another podcast, we can someone else has done a lot more of it than I, because it is a big question, because people would, when they heard that we worked with chaplains and medics, and we worked pre-deployment, so that they would be able to bring, you know, a mindful awareness into whatever they were doing in the field and be resilient because they were seeing so much horror. It was during, you know, the worst times in Afghanistan and Iraq. And people would so often say, you're just teaching people to kill people better. Well, now I can't like give you a couple of lines about, you know, why that's not true. But I saw the most really beautiful changes in people. And I saw how it really helped them, especially in those days of the, this is like 2008, 2009, going into villages in Afghanistan. And, you know, the army's taught, to kill people pretty quickly. Although the army will say they want that to be the last resort. Well, we are seeing it in the police as well. They're taught that it's the last choice. But in fact, when they get into these situations, whether through, you know, we don't know, fear, bias, whatever, it's often the first choice. And so we worked a lot with people, with soldiers, like helping them see in their minds and helping them touch into the places of compassion in themselves so that they could appreciate that people in these villages were, you know, they were, and we did this practice, I do a lot, compassion practice called Just Like Me. Yeah, they're really different. They're on the other side of the world. And yes, there are soldiers there who are trying to kill you. But many people you encounter are not, and they are other human beings just like you. Anyhow, I'm just touching on it because it's such a big...
Yes, this is a broad question. Yeah. You mentioned that compassion practice is just like me. Yeah. How can we practice this thing in our life?
Well, I think right now, this is a really critical practice. I mean, I think all these practices can really, really help us. First, with the coronavirus, it helps us look at all these emotions that are arising. I mean, even after writing that book for 2 years with Ramdas on dying and thinking about dying a lot, and I turned 80 recently. So, I mean, it's on my mind. I've thought about it a lot. But I have to say that coronavirus, like, and being locked up here for 3 months, I saw some fears in there that I did not think were in there. So I think that mindfulness really helps us see what's there and then hold it in a way, you know, so that we can just look at, you know, bring our fears close to us and then let go what's not relevant. You know, yeah, someday I will die, but that will be a moment when I'm dying. Right now, I'm not dying, which is really good to look and see what these fears are that are keeping me from being, you know, fully here right now. So
fear is always there. And if I have your permission, I would like to state that I get this fear in my body when it comes to having relationships or relationships with opposite sex. Yeah. I get this fear, okay, how it is going to happen. These attachments naturally come, and I would say that mindfulness and meditation really helped me to release and letting go of those attachments.
Oh, I'm so happy to hear that. You know, Ramda said something when we were writing a book, because the book's about dying and loving, that he said we get afraid of relationships because at some point they will end. Even if you, like your parents, are married for a really long time, eventually one person will go before the other. And that fear of loss is that fear of death is embedded in all our relationships. I mean, there are lots of other reasons to be fearful about relationships. I can say this, a person who's been married 3 times. But it's interesting that deep fear is our fear of that we carry through life, and it affects so many things, that fear of death.
Yes. So
looking at that, we're bringing up the biggest topics in the world. And we have 1 minute for each one of them. But yeah, so I'm not being frivolous here, but do spend some time trying to get over your fear of death. It really will help.
As we were talking about coronavirus, how are you staying calm? So do you have any special practice or anything you do to be calm and relaxed with yourself and with your loved ones?
Well, I would go back to basic mindfulness practice. You know, just allow yourself to breathe. I mean, just noticing your breathing can really change things. And then see what's arising. And, you know, and just letting it go if it's, you know, it's, you don't need it right now. You know, you can see that you're afraid, you can see, but, and it might help you think about what is it, if you're afraid that you might get the virus and die, then, you know, why are you afraid of that? What is it that you would want to do with your life that you couldn't do if you died? So start doing that now, whatever that is. The other thing is, I mean, you asked me about Just Like Me, and I wanted to say that there is a practice in which, and it's in the back of that book, and where we bring to mind another person. And then right now we're celebrating our differences. You know, we're celebrating that all, you know, the difference in all of our lives, and that we have to celebrate the each of us, you know. We have to honor that Black Lives Matter, or we're not going to be able to rest in the idea that all lives matter. We have to honor our differences. And at the same time, it's important to remember the ways in which we are all, what it is we share as humans, and that we, you know, that we all suffer, and we all don't want to suffer, and all want to be happy. And so in all these ways, you are just like me. And then we have each other's incredible differences to celebrate. And that practice is basically a compassion practice. And I've been teaching it more and more because people are so grateful to have that kind of breakthrough. And I think that practice can really help us now as we're in the middle of this unfolding around social justice and how important just, you know, Cornel West said justice is love, what love looks like in public, that we've, you know, if you do any of these practices at all, you'll get the glimpse. We've got to move toward a world that is kind and compassionate and just for all of us. And I just think that these practices are critical at this time and really help, really help.
Thank you so much for explaining it, by the way. I love how you explain that. Since we have limited time, and I would like to ask you, not the last question, one last question before I ask you the last question is, what books have inspired you in your life so much?
Oh, goodness.
If anyone comes to your mind. Apart from your own books.
Yeah, well, no, you know, if you, when you write a book, then you leave it, you kind of leave it behind. well, many, many. I mean, I was a literature graduate student, so I read like hundreds of books. But right now, I am loving a book by a good friend, Rhonda McGee, and it is called The Inner Work of Social Justice. And she gives wonderful practices in there. They're mindfulness-based practices for, you know, looking at what's within you that you still need to discover. That's been a really great book. And gosh, there are so many. I think, yeah, reading, Ramdas wrote a book that includes lots of practices in it called Polishing the Mirror. That's really a great one.
Great. And we'll put all these details in the blog page. And, I remember having some conversation with Rhonda McGee, and I was asking her to be on the podcast. Yeah.
Oh, she's fabulous. You know, then gosh, anything by Norman Fisher, who is was the Zen abbot of the San Francisco Zen Center. And now he has his own thing called Everyday Zen. He's a good friend and really wonderful.
Yeah.
So if you read those three, you'll be
set for life.
Set for life, right.
Well, Mirabai, and I would like to ask you my last question. What is the impact or legacy you want to leave on this world?
Well, I think just that one person spent her life trying to figure out what it means to love everyone and serve everyone. And it's different for everybody. But I think you can't go wrong. You can go wrong. You can make mistakes. But it's a really good guide through life. And that's what I've been trying to do.
Love everyone, serve everyone. I am so thrilled and honored to have you, Mirabai Bush. And before we conclude this conversation, I would like to quote from Ram Dass. We are all just walking each other home, Ram Dass.
Yes.
Thank you, Mirabai Bush. Thank you so much.
I love
touched.
Being with you. Thank you.
Thank you
and
so much.
We'll just stay in touch.
Thank you for listening to this podcast episode today. If you did enjoy this, please subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, or you can visit https://nishantgarg.me, nishantgarg.me. You can also share this episode with your loved ones to help them live a fulfilled life. You are not alone in this journey. We all struggle in life. There is no shame in talking about it. I go through my highs and lows. I get depressed, and these practices help me in living a resilient life. You can also do this. You got this. Don't judge yourself. You are doing the best you can. And thank you so much again.